I remember a time in my life when I thought God had really abandoned me. I couldn't imagine why he had gone in the direction that he did, why he had brought me to the place that he had, and I really had to struggle immensely with which direction do I want to go in. I remember sitting on my bed literally and rocking back and forth with agony. But that was a deciding moment in my life, a moment when I decided to not fight God, but to go in his direction, to want him, even at great cost to myself.
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. Our hosts are Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. Jack is a philosopher by training, but his real passion is the Bible, having studied and taught it for more than 25 years. He is currently on staff at Mackenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College in Eugene, Oregon. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist, having practiced in California and Oregon for over 20 years. She is employed by the Caris Foundation, a teaching and counseling ministry. In this series, titled Being a Christian, Jack and Christine discuss the most important biblical concepts of the Christian life. Now, here are Jack and Christine.
Even though I know it's not true in my head, Jack, when I hear that somebody is a mature person, I think of somebody pretty immediately that doesn't make the kinds of mistakes I do, or doesn't make the bad choices that I make. Someone who's pretty well got it together in terms of their choices, their lifestyle, they're not stumbling. And yet I think in the Bible there's a whole different picture of maturity, especially in the person of King David. And I'd like to approach talking about him today.
Okay.
So you're on. Let's talk about
King. Talk about King David.
Yeah.
Well, before we get to that, maybe let me make a distinction, and I think we covered it in a prior session, but just so that it's clear before us. I think there's really two different senses in which we could talk about maturity. And one sense, I don't know if the Bible ever explicitly uses maturity in this sense, but I think it logically follows from the picture of sanctification that you have in the Bible. One way of talking about maturity would be to talk about having arrived in some sense at a certain point, at a certain designated point, in a process of growth or development. And of course, the process that we're talking about, the development we're talking about, is the development, is the process of sanctification and the development of a heart that loves God, that seeks to know God, that seeks to obey God, that loves what God loves, likes what God likes, that kind of thing. Now, on the one hand, we could talk about maturity in such a way that we would have to acknowledge ultimately that nobody is completely mature. That's the one sense of maturity that we can talk about. I mean, do we ever arrive at a point where we are so thoroughly committed to what God is committed to and so thoroughly value what God values that we couldn't be strengthened in our commitment to that and couldn't increase in our commitment to those values? I think the answer to that seems to me is clearly no. At least I can say for myself, I'm not mature in that sense. I still recognize how much further I have to go before my values have really completely been subsumed under the values of God himself. How much more easily, how much more readily I could give my allegiance to what is right and good and not fight it and not resist it and not not try to avoid the appropriate decisions and so on. So in that sense, nobody in the Bible, not me, nobody I know, nobody nowhere, is fully mature, is truly mature. On the other hand, the Bible makes a distinction between those of you who are mature as opposed to those of you who are not, where it seems to be talking about categories. There are the mature and there are those who are not mature. Well, what is that talking about? maturity in that sense, it seems to me, has kind of put its finger on a point in the process of sanctification, in the process of our growth and development, that is kind of a decisive turning point in a person's life. And if you've passed that point, you are mature. And if you've not arrived at that point yet, you're really not mature yet. So what is that point? I don't know that the Bible ever really truly explicitly defines it, but I think logically it would make sense that what they have in mind is what I call having reached a point of no return. That is where the closest we get to any language that seeks to describe it is when Paul says in his prayer to the Colossians, I pray that you might become grounded and settled. The idea being, I think, that we're no longer precariously perched on our hope and on our belief, such that some wind could come along and blow us off or knock us off. We're grounded now. We're settled. We have been, like a piston in a car engine is seated in the cylinder. It's down there, locked in place, where it ought to be.
Not going anywhere.
Not going anywhere else. Yeah, exactly. In the contrary is described by Paul to Timothy in his letters. People who are blown around by every wind of doctrine. James calls them
unstable.
Unstable in all their ways is another word he uses. Something and unstable in all their ways. Double-minded, for example, he uses. That's somebody who's not mature. And in this other sense, they have not arrived at a point where they're really there to stay. They're on this journey that they're not going to turn back from anymore. And I think that's what mature means usually when the Bible describes it. So we have to keep that in mind, because we're going to see in these people like David, David does reach a point of maturity, but even in his maturity, he's not mature in the other sense.
He's not mature in the sense that he has no more room for growth
for
and
growth.
Development.
Exactly.
But he is firmly seated in his position of wanting to follow God.
Exactly.
He's determined. He's on the course. It's set.
Right.
However, Jack, David makes tremendous mistakes.
Right. And David is particularly tough to apply this analysis to, because I don't know, I don't know if I can discern. Maybe it's partly because I have not studied it thoroughly enough. I haven't actually made a study out of David's life. Maybe if I had, I'd be in a better position to say so. But there was obviously a turning point in David's life when he committed adultery with Bathsheba, arranged for the murder of Uriah. Those are horrendous evils in his life. I mean, real black marks on his moral reputation.
You know what just went through my mind? I was thinking, you know, David is such a story of so long ago, and I've heard it so many times that it loses its impact a bit just in remembering it. So what flashed through my mind was, okay, Christine, think about cheating on my husband. Think about me having an affair with somebody against Larry.
Mm-hmm.
Because it would be against my husband as well as against me and God.
And then hiring somebody to kill him, I guess.
Right. And then being a murderer.
Yeah.
What about me doing that? And all of a sudden it looked very black to me. It,
right.
It changed position from this character in history to, oh, that was a real person like me who, if I did that, wow.
Right.
That's huge.
Right. And so on the one hand, you know, my knee-jerk reaction is, when King David did that, clearly he wasn't even a believer. I mean, how could he have been a believer? And I think that would be a relatively common response in the Christian culture today, because of our theological assumptions. We tend to assume that nothing that horrendous could ever be done by a true believer, somebody who is being sanctified. And I'm sympathetic with that. I mean, that's certainly my initial reaction, is that is just too horrendous for any child of God to have done that. On the other hand, look at all the evidence that that David trusted God. I mean, the whole Goliath story happened before that. the...
Was he being pursued by Saul before or after that?
Yeah, before that. All that whole story of David's acknowledgement of the role of Saul and his refusal to kill Saul, even though he had several opportunities to do so, because that was God's anointed. I mean, his respect for God. So he becomes really a tough call. I mean, on the one hand, he seems from very early on in his life to be on the journey of his life toward the love of God and the knowledge of God, and to have some aspects of that very well developed quite early in his life. And then this is the very same man who commits adultery and arranges a murder. Was his adultery and his murder out of immaturity, his lack of full development in his commitment to the things of God, or was that his conversion experience? Was that when he finally got on the road to true sanctification, is when Nathan the prophet came up to him, said to David, "You're the man," and David melted and softened and repented.
Okay, for the help of people who may not know that story well, "You're the man" is an abbreviated way of talking about it, and
and in our idiom sounds a little different.
Yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah.
You the man.
You the man. Yeah, sounds okay. You know, you Michael Jordan. You know, so I wonder if you'll go back and just kind of briefly explain the story for people who may not have it.
Okay, Nathan was a prophet that was active in the time and lifetime of David. God came to Nathan and revealed to Nathan David's sin.
David's sin that he had
committed
adultery with Bathsheba, and that he had plotted to murder.
Yeah, murder Bathsheba's husband. And then he married Bathsheba after having eliminated Uriah. And we should point out, as part of the story, there are a lot of psalms that you read that come out of that period in David's life where David is obviously trying all he has been trying with all of his might to just kind of deny the fact that he had done such a horrendous evil. And the psalms are his poems that he wrote exploring how impossible it was for him to do that. And he describes the experience in very graphic terms. "My bones were melting within me," and all kinds of vivid language that's very descriptive of the kind of inner turmoil and anguish and
guilt
and guilt and all the stuff that he was dealing with. So David is having his own internal struggles. God sends Nathan the prophet to David, and Nathan approaches David by telling him a parable. He just comes before the throne. And we have to appreciate what a courageous thing this is for Nathan to do. Because a king in the worldview of the ancient Israelites and then surrounding nations, a king basically had power of life and death over the citizens. He could have had Nathan beheaded on the spot if he had chosen to. I don't know if that's how the kings of Israel operated. I don't think we have any evidence one way or the other, but it's a fair assumption that they did, given that that was certainly the way all the monarchs of the surrounding nations behaved, the kind of authority they had. Well, if that's true, Nathan is taking his life in his hands to go before David to rebuke David, because if David doesn't respond well, if David responds defensively, he has the power in his defensiveness to literally have him slain. So Nathan is taking his life in his hands, but he's a prophet, a godly man who obeys the voice of the Lord. So he just does what the Lord has told him to do. He goes before the king, and he tells David a parable. And the parable is about a shepherd who steals another shepherd's sheep, I believe it is, if I remember correctly. And I don't remember the detail of the story that corresponds to the murder, but he tells a story about two shepherds with sheep and the mean, nasty thing that one shepherd does to the other. And Nathan ends the parable by saying, "What should be done here, David?" And David comes out with this righteous indignation about...
Just an outrage.
An outrage about what the horrible things that this shepherd in the parable has done. And after David has expressed his outrage at what this guy has done, Nathan looks at David and says, you're that man, you're that shepherd, in effect. You're
who
the one
just
who has
been
done,
outraged.
Yeah. Your outrage that has been directed at your own actions, David, is what he's saying. And David, instead of responding defensively, responds for, well, as a child of God ought to respond to that kind of revelation. He repents, and I don't, what, sackcloth and ashes or something, I don't remember exactly the details, but he repents, he responds with mourning toward his own evil. Now, one way of looking at that account could be that is his conversion experience. That he has finally come to a point in his life where the last refuge of unbelief in him has been conquered, and that now he's past that. Did I say conversion? I guess I don't mean that. I mean that's the event in his life where he passes from the point of having a faith that's fragile to having a faith now that is past the point of no return. There's no going back now. God has so conquered all of the strongholds of unbelief in David now that now his destiny is fixed. I don't think it's his conversion experience in the sense that clearly it's not his turning from not trading with God to now trading with God. He has been trading with God for a long time. And what I mean by that is doing business with God, relating his life to the will of God and the requirements of God and so on. I mean, I think that's pretty clear. But I think arguably we could make the case that nonetheless, as much as he's been walking down the road and journeying with God, seeking to know God and seeking to obey God, there were these areas of his life that were hidden from God, that David was trying to hide from God, that until he relinquished them, David's destiny was still in the balance. And arguably, it's only after that event that finally the die is cast and David's destiny is put in concrete. In other words, he reached the point of maturity in that second sense that I defined. He became a member of the mature as opposed to simply being immature in his faith. We're so accustomed to seeing conversion because we think in terms of becoming a Christian, and that becoming a Christian is kind of the point of no return. You know, we've finally taken that step that settles our destiny. But I think far more significant is the kind of event that we're talking about with Nathan, where my faith is no longer fragile, it's no longer vulnerable, it finally reaches a point of being grounded and settled and a decided thing. That reaching that point is the far more significant point in our life. Because we can become a Christian for a lot of different reasons. We can declare our allegiance to Jesus for a lot of different reasons. We can decide to disciple ourselves to Jesus for a lot of different reasons. But whether or not that means we're a child of God has yet to be decided. It's going to be decided later when we reach those crisis points in our life that get decided the right way.
Or would it be right to say that perhaps it certainly has been decided by God? Mm-hmm. He sees the choices we're going to be making up ahead. And yet, it isn't firmly grounded in our own hearts,
right,
which direction we're going.
Yeah, that's much more accurate. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's not like our destiny is in the balance as far as God is concerned. Because for anybody who's listened to our program, my firm conviction is that we are elect from before the foundation of the earth. God knows my destiny before he even creates me. So it's not like God is waiting to see what I'm going to do. But from the standpoint of my own experience, as I can know myself, I can't really know myself with any foundation for my knowledge until we reach those events in our life that really decide our fate by the decision we make.
And really the decision that David made was one that we all eventually make as believers.
Have to, exactly. Yeah.
We come up against something big in our lives and it's either or. I go this direction or that. when Nathan came and confronted Dave that it wasn't, well, I was kind of wrong. It was either he repented or he defended himself. And the defense would have been having him go in a completely different direction. The repentance, of course, in the direction toward God. Mm-hmm. But that's absolutely essential in all our lives to finally have to kind of make that decision. And usually it's at great cost to ourselves.
Expound on that. Usually at great cost to ourselves in terms of having to give up something big in our life that we have thought was pretty important, is it?
Yeah. Or maybe not give up a thing, but have to see ourselves as a sinner. I think that's maybe what David did.
Right.
Maybe for him he had to be humbled, because as it seems to me, his sin came out perhaps because he was king, and he thought he had ultimate rule. He could kind of do anything he pleased, mm-hmm. and as far as, you know, commit adultery and murder. Mm-hmm. And his power as king kind of gave him the opportunity to do that, perhaps even without any recourse,
right.
unless God had a recourse, because he really could have gotten it away with it, apart from God confronting him.
Yeah, in a sense, it was totally socially acceptable, given his standing. I mean, that's just what kings do, and I think that would have been well accepted by a lot of people, and so it provided a very, very convenient and forceful rationalization for his evil.
Totally.
Yeah.
And so what he would have had to do is give up all those rationalizations, give up, I think, ultimately, the fact that he thought he had complete power and to be humbled. And that's what he had to give up, perhaps more than anything.
Yeah.
And we think about it in terms of, well, you know, you might have to give up, he had to give up Bathsheba, maybe, but it was bigger. It was kind of something within his own heart that he was holding on to, perhaps a prideful justification of his standing, and he got put in his place alongside all normal people in the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
all us regulars that aren't kings.
Yeah, and your point, which I agree with, it's well taken, is that decision that any of us make is going to have to involve some kind of cost to our self-image, to our putting to death some delusion, some illusion about ourselves. Or it may cost something in terms of something I'm attached to in this world. Yeah, something will be very costly. That's what Jesus is trying to say when he says, unless a seed go into the ground and die, it cannot bring forth life. Unless we take up our cross and follow him and die to ourselves, we cannot be his disciple. That it's a prerequisite. There's no other way to life except through
death.
That death to ourselves.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
That's the place from which I do a whole lot of counseling. And I guess that's kind of the theme, or kind of the foundation of where I go. Where in the counseling world, it's kind of make yourself feel better and not really have to pay a cost for that, but kind of look at the good inside of you. It's quite the opposite. It's you're going to have to die to the things inside of you that are creating problems for yourself and for other people that are sinful, and that death is very costly and very painful. I was having a discussion with my husband a couple of days ago, and we were both upset about some things that we saw in each other, just some arguments that we had kind of brought out some stuff that I just really don't like about him and he really doesn't like about me. And I said, you know, I'm just not the person that I thought I was when I married you. And he said, yeah, I'm not the person I thought I was when I married you. I've had to look and see myself completely differently than what I perceive myself to be, because through our marriage it's brought out the core of who we are, our sinfulness. And I think that has been the greatest cost for me, is having a perspective of myself that's very different than what I thought it was. And not as an excuse, but I'm in seeing things, I try hard to work in a direction of making good choices and yet see myself failing a lot. And that is a continual dying to myself. And I guess that's kind of my point here is, yeah, I think we have a real turning point where we recognize something, and then where it's a decisive point where we turn toward wanting God, or actually toward defensiveness or self-justification and going the other way. But even as we turn toward God, there's those time after time after time in our life where we're where we're having to face into a death that's costly, that's painful, that's humbling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's why the distinction I made earlier is so important. I'm not suggesting for a second that once David confronted Nathan, he didn't have more to learn.
That he wasn't done.
Yeah, he's not done at all by any means. And I think we see areas. I don't know his life well enough to put my finger on them off the top of my head. But as we go through his life, we see still areas where he's clearly not mature. I mean, clearly not getting it completely. I look at my own life. There were a couple of crisis events in my life that were just so life-changing that from then on, every time I have confronted another issue, it's not like my life is in the balance on those issues. It's only a matter of time that I know I'm going to have to do the right thing. Whereas in those initial really critical events, it really is like my life was in the balance. What are you going to decide here, Jack? You're going to define your entire destiny by what you decide here. And I haven't had that same sense about those other choices because I don't think it's true. My destiny has already been defined. I already know the outcome. I already know what I have to do. It's just a question of how stubbornly I'm going to resist it before I give in.
When is it going to catch up to you?
Yeah, right.
But if we're believers, it ends up catching up to us.
It has to, yeah, and will.
You know, Jack, I think there's such danger in thinking that we're done. And, you know, as Christians, I think are really given that message sometimes. I really think I was, that once you become a Christian, you're kind of all better and you're just kind of got some shining up to do. And that leads then to self-justification, where instead of me really being willing to look at the fact that I'm, for example, being hurtful to my husband, I'll justify it because I have the sense that I'm supposed to be already mature, already done. And so I can't bear to see the fact that I have sinned as profoundly as I have, and that it infiltrates my whole soul and my whole being, and that it's a mess down there. And so I think that's really a hindrance for people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. It was certainly a picture that was confusing to me. I can remember in my early efforts at evangelism and defending the faith, apologetics and so on, oftentimes the arguments that I would go to, encouraged, I think, by all the attitudes of other Christians around me, is to make the case, look at how much my life has changed now that I've become to Jesus. You should become a Christian because it'll change your life. And the problem was that if I were honest with myself, I could point to all kinds of things in human experience that changed people's lives. Joining other religions changed people's lives. Becoming an atheist changed people's lives. Becoming a Marxist changed people's lives. I mean, there are all kinds of things. And sometimes it was for the better, but oftentimes oftentimes it was for the better. So I began to realize what an anemic argument it was. Come to Jesus so that you'll change your life for the better. Well, why Jesus? Why not something else if I want to change my life to the better? And it started this process of thinking, what is really going on here? Is that all this is about? Is just changing our life for the better? No. It's about getting in touch with the truth, about getting in touch with reality, about having my life go the way the Creator would have it go. Not just getting better than it was, but having it aim toward the target that we ought to be aiming toward. And the next thing that I began to notice then is what a long process that is. It's not just you walk forward at an evangelistic crusade and you give your life to Jesus, and the next day you're halfway there, and the day after that you're three-quarters of the way there, and give you a week and you're a believer. You're really established. It just doesn't work that way. And yet I think there was a whole culture around me that pictured it as that easy. I think what we have said is it's supernatural. It can be quick because it's supernatural. I'm thoroughly convinced it's supernatural, but it ain't quick. God just isn't doing it that way.
So, Jack, what do you think about going on and talking about Peter?
Okay, Peter.
You're on.
Okay, Peter's interesting because he, as you see him in the pages of the Gospel, he means well, but he just clearly is not, but he's clearly sort of clueless about what this is really all about. You see his bravado. Lord, even if everybody deserts you, I won't desert you. Well, actually, Peter, you're going to deny me three times tonight, as a matter of fact. You see his...
How crushing to the man's ego.
Yeah.
He's coming up almost like on a white stallion, and Jesus just kind of knocks him off there, doesn't he?
I mean, there's two crucial moments in Peter's life, it seems to me. One is his denial of Jesus, because when you read the accounts in all the different Gospels and put all the pieces together, it's a really poignant story. What Jesus is saying is that on three... He's not saying you're going to deny me three times tonight, actually. What he's saying is more significant than that. On three separate occasions tonight, Peter, you're going to deny me. Actually, the occasions consisted of protracted denials. I mean, picture him around the campfire in the courtyard of the high priest where he was kind of waiting to see what was going to happen with Jesus, who was inside being tried by the Sanhedrin, well, being interviewed by the chief priest and with this kind of phony trial. And he's standing around warming himself at the fire, and I don't remember who they were right at the moment, but somebody says, I think I know you. I think I recognize you. Aren't you one of Jesus' disciples? No, I'm not. I'm not one of his disciples. Somebody else from the fire says, yes, you are. I remember seeing you. No, I swear, I'm not. Somebody else across the fire, but you are. I saw you too. No, I'm not. I mean, he just has to continually, to more than one person on any given occasion, lie to them, denying that he is a disciple, denying that he knows Jesus, swearing that he is not a follower of Jesus, and finally has to leave in order to escape, you know, the pressure of this crowd who's insisting that he really is. And then it happens, the same thing happens again at another location, in the vicinity, but in another location. Then he comes back to the fire, and the whole thing happens a third time. And what's really poignant is, and then Jesus says, this is going to happen before the cock has crowed twice. So I can't remember the chronology now as I put it together, but I think it's after the second occasion at which he denies Jesus, the cock crows. Okay, you would think at that point...
It would wake him up.
But even after that, there's still the third occasion where he denies Jesus. And two things happen at once at that point. The cock crows the second time as he's denying Jesus this third time. And Jesus is being led out of the building, and their eyes meet.
Oh, man. Busted.
And that's when Peter melts and runs away and weeps. That had to be an incredibly significant event in his life, because after all of his false bravado and Jesus saying, doesn't work that way, Peter finally realizes how totally inadequate his faith is, how totally inadequate his discipleship is, how clueless he is, how much he doesn't get it, and a real process of self-evaluation must have ensued from that.
Bravado is just not going to make it.
Yeah.
Using words, trying to act like it's there, believing perhaps in himself that it's there, didn't work. And maybe that's what he had to learn, was he really thought it was there,
mm-hmm.
a real significant commitment to Christ. And that's how he went through life, kind of with this bravado, believing things that were not true.
Right. Yeah, he had to learn the difference between discipleship, faith, belief, as simply an outward thing that you plaster on, as opposed to it being a deep-seated inner reality in your being. And I think that's the event where he figured out there's a difference here. Now, we don't know what transpired in the interim, so exactly. I mean, we know some things. Jesus does appear to him in the feed my sheep conversation on the shore of Galilee. But we're dealing with a much humbler, meeker, more chagrined Peter, I think, at that point. But the next turning point for Peter is then Pentecost. And Pentecost, of course, was a turning point for all of them. In effect, what's happening there is God is supernaturally turning the lights on in their brains at that point. They have all this fragmentary knowledge of things that Jesus has taught them and the arguments that he's given them and scriptures that he's used to persuade them of the truth. And all that stuff is stored there from 2 and 3 years of having been instructed by him. But none of them really have put it all together and the light gone, and they haven't had that aha experience where they go, oh, I get it. That's what this is all about. And simply God has been withholding that from them. He just simply has not blessed them with that understanding and that insight. He's saving it for a dramatic historical event at Pentecost, where in all the events surrounding Pentecost, the most significant thing that he's doing is pouring out the Spirit of truth on them. In other words, putting forth, providentially deciding, now I'm going to flip the switch of knowledge in your brain, and now you're going to get it. And across the board, the disciples, the early disciples there, the light goes on all at once, and they begin eloquently and articulately proclaiming coherently the truth of the gospel. And from then on, I mean, they get it, they understand, they're no longer clueless.
It was really a turning point for them.
Yeah. Now, that was an unusual event. I mean, none of us are going to, God was doing more than just working in their personal lives in the event of Pentecost. He was doing something, bringing about a whole transition in history itself at that point. So that's not an event that we would expect to replicate in our lives, I think. That was a unique historical event. But Peter happens to have lived at a time where that coincided with his own personal sanctification as well. And I think that was clearly finally the point of no return for Peter, was Pentecost.
It's kind of like when the piston was seated in the engine.
Yeah.
And it's not coming out.
Yeah.
And he's headed in a decidedly different direction.
Right, for keeps.
Jack, do you see any women in the Bible who we can talk about that exhibit this kind of maturity?
Yes, it's harder to you can't trace their development in the way that you can the men, simply because you don't have women who play the roles that lead the biblical writers to give you enough information about them. But you certainly see snapshots and portraits of women who have arrived in one way or another.
Have arrived in the sense of being firmly directed toward wanting to pursue God in their lives.
Right. And who manifest in a solid, consistent way one or more of the attributes of a mature disciple, somebody who's really decidedly gone this direction and is living out their life in the light of the truth of the gospel that they have firmly and irrevocably embraced. Just recently, I've been teaching through the book of Acts, and we run across the woman Tabitha or Tabitha, or the Greek is Dorcas. And the reason for describing her life at all is because she lived in Joppa as this remarkable woman that I'll describe in a second, but she dies, and the disciples in Joppa come down to a nearby village to bring Peter up, and Peter comes up and ends up reviving her from the dead, I mean, resuscitating her, bringing her back to life. And that had a huge impact on Joppa, that miracle. And a lot of people became disciples because of that event. Now, the purpose in Luke describing that event has more to do with, I think, at this point, with contrasting the working of God through the ministry of Peter in the lives of the Jews, in contrast to the utter failure of the Apostle Paul in ministering in the lives of Jews. Paul ended up being driven out of Judea completely because there was a plot against his life, because he'd go out and try to persuade them to become Christians and they'd get mad at him and want to kill him. Peter, on the other hand, had some measure of success going around Judea and proclaiming the gospel. And there are a number of Jews in the regions of Judea who believed and who did come through Peter's ministry to become disciples of Jesus. And I think that that's the purpose in chapter 9 of Acts, of contrasting them. And Joppa was just one of those places where Peter and his ministry and the miracles God performed through him were effective in bringing people to the Lord. So that's why it's there in the book of Acts. It's not really about Dorcas. But in the process of describing that event, the reason that it had such an impact is because Dorcas was a dear person to the entire community. She had endeared herself virtually to everybody. I mean, there wasn't the impression you get in reading it is you'd be hard put to find anybody who didn't like Dorcas. And why? It's because she had been such an incredibly compassionate woman. Evidently, what she had done is devoted her life to making clothing, tunics and other garments, and just giving them as gifts to people who needed them. It particularly describes the widows that were there mourning her death. Well, our concept of widow is so very different than a widow in the ancient Near East, because widows were the most socially disenfranchised people. Widows and orphans were the most socially disenfranchised people in their society.
So you're saying more than destitute financially, they were people who were looked down upon.
Yeah, they had no social standing. They had no legal recourse. People could easily take advantage of them because they had, you remember the parable Jesus told about the widow coming to the unrighteous judge. She was completely at the mercy of that judge. She had no legal power, no place to go. If the judge would not be just, she was up a creek without a paddle. They were financially destitute. They were just there to be victimized by whoever would victimize them. So they were at the mercy of all the other people in the society.
And it would have been justified in that society then not to care about them, perhaps.
Yeah.
It would be okay to kick these people around, and here we have Dorcas or Tabitha, whoever, mm-hmm. however, whatever name we want to give her, doing the opposite, really valuing them and giving her life to care about them.
Exactly, exactly. And the other thing that we have to appreciate is to give someone a garment is not like us giving someone a garment. For us, clothes are relatively cheap. For them, in their economy, clothes were a big deal. I mean, it would be maybe more akin to giving someone a car in our society. It would not be unusual for somebody in their society to have only two sets of clothes, or if you're poor, only one set of clothes that was really worn and ragged, and they just couldn't afford to get any more clothes. So to give someone a garment, a tunic, maybe not a car, but would be like giving somebody a gift worth $1,000 or $2,000 or something like that. I haven't done the math on it, but just in terms of the emotional impact, it's an incredibly significant gift. So no wonder, you know, she had endeared herself to so many people because she just had this reputation of having a heart of compassion that wasn't stopping. And the other impression you get is that this was a woman who was giving, but her giving was not selective. I can't prove that from the text, but that's certainly the impression it's giving, is that there didn't appear to be anyone that she wouldn't have been willing to give to, that was not a target of her generosity. Many people one of the evils that can creep into our lives is selective generosity. I want friends. I want people gathered around me. I want a little group to be my fan club, I go out to create that for myself. And the way I create that for myself is I lavish gifts on the select few that I want to be a part of that inner circle that I'm trying to create for myself.
And I appear to them to be very generous and very good.
Exactly.
But I'm just building a kind of little island for myself.
Yeah, a little fortress for myself. Exactly. And it's not that the generosity is not generosity. It is. But it's not the generosity of an authentic child of God, because the generosity of an authentic child of God is not at all selective. Anybody is potentially the target for my generosity. if I'm to be merciful as my Father in heaven is merciful, if I'm to be loving as my Father is loving, if I'm going to demonstrate his generosity, then there will be no boundaries and no limits on my generosity. And Dorcas appears to have had an authentic generosity that knew no limits.
So applying it to our theme today of maturity, then you might say that Dorcas was a woman who was mature because she was a person who was willing to lavish generosity on anybody, and she wasn't a selector of persons.
Exactly, yeah. See, what's the, as James puts it, no respecter of persons. No.
I said selector of persons.
But yeah,
that's pretty close.
Yeah.
I think I had that in the back of my mind somewhere, and it didn't kind of come forth quite
so,
right. Yeah.
Yeah,
it rhymes, so it was probably right.
But she was no selector of persons too. I mean, that's a good way to describe it. She was not selective in her generosity. Her
and compassion. You know, Jack, there's so many people who are not the people, there's so many of us who are selecting particular people, and we're building kind of a fortress, as you said, around us of these people that we like. And I've just heard from so many people, and certainly from myself, my own experience, that it's really painful.
Mm-hmm. To the outsiders.
Oh, it's particular. Very painful to the outsiders to not be selected, and to know they're not, and usually they haven't been selected their whole lives for some reason or another. And I really struggle with that, with some people who I especially struggle when I see a certain kind of way of dealing with life that feels really, it feels scary to me. It feels pathological to me. It feels like I'm walking into a snake pit, and all the snakes are all not necessarily evil, but just that, like a bunch of chains that are, maybe that's better, like I put a bunch of chains in my jewelry box and then I try and go get them, and there's like 20 chains all mixed together. And I will be a selector. I will not select that kind of person because it takes a tremendous amount of work to be with them. It's really hard for me to take the time to do that, especially since I do it in my work a lot, which is kind of interesting. I'm always with that kind of person in my work. And maybe that has something to do with it. I'm pretty tired, and I see the amount of work that it takes to really care about that person.
The bottom line of your point is that's wrong or right, or what are you saying about that?
Well, I'm saying that it's really natural to select people.
Yes.
And that it takes a lot of work to work against doing that.
Well,
And it isn't always, you can't select everybody.
Right.
But I think it's an attitude of willingness to do that.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's where I need to go with these people, is a willingness. I might not even ever have the energy to do it, but I need to not see them as worse than myself.
Right.
But
as unworthy of my time and generosity. And
yeah, they are worthy of my time and generosity. I may, for a variety of reasons, not give it.
Right.
But they're not as important as me, or not as valuable as me, or worse than me. It's just that happens to be the kind of thing that's real difficult for me to approach. And, which is interesting, I really approach it. I really go for it in my work.
No, I think that's a very important point. I mean, I don't want people to feel falsely guilty and condemning and immature just because they're finite human beings.
Okay.
We do have to be selective in our relationships because of our finiteness. But it's one thing to be selective because of our finiteness. It's another thing to be selective out of a very skewed value system. And that's what's really ultimately evil. Mm-hmm. Typically, when it's out of a skewed value system, you'll see two sides of it. I will be lavishly generous toward the people I have selected, and I will be to some extent actually I will in some tangible way reject other people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a telltale sign that we're not talking about somebody who's just coming to terms with their finiteness. There's something else going on here.
And what is that? I think it's, using our theme, I think it's a real evidence of a lack of maturity.
Exactly.
And a need to grow in our development. I think people get really good at that. I am really put off by people who seek me out, that don't seek other people out, that I think are, I might be in a social situation where I'm standing talking to somebody who may be seen like a like a widow in our society. Mm-hmm. And the attention is turned to me and not to that person. And that's a very difficult thing for me. Very uncomfortable. And I'm sure you've probably experienced that as the pastor of a church. You know, people might want to get to know you and not somebody else. And mm-hmm. that's very uncomfortable. And I think that's also something I need to deal with and say, okay, my lack of maturity could even reject that person for rejecting this other person.
Right.
And so it's really a lot of work to keep on looking clearly at the truth of my life.
Yeah.
And I think that is the hallmark of maturity.
Right.
Jack and Christine will return in a moment. Almost 20 years ago, the McKenzie Study Center in Eugene, Oregon, was created as a place where people could come and seriously think about their faith. Over the years, McKenzie has grown in different directions and gone through various changes, but one thing has remained constant: a passionate love of God's Word and the truth it contains. The McKenzie staff is dedicated to studying and understanding the Bible. Individually, they want to know what the biblical authors meant when they wrote the Bible. They want to peel away layers of false teaching and get to the very heart of the biblical message. And this is not easy. It's hard work. It requires years of dedication and the willingness to believe what the Bible actually says rather than what they might want it to say. These men and women also believe their studies and their teaching are not perfect. They know their understanding is limited, and they may be wrong, but they trust God to give them the eyes to clearly see His truth. They also encourage others to join them in their efforts, to ask them tough questions, to challenge their conclusions, and to take the Bible seriously. More importantly, they desire that all may come to the wonderful saving truth of the gospel. Much of the teaching done at McKenzie is available on tape and can be ordered from the tape catalog. Papers and the free monthly newsletter News and Views are also available. Information about how you can find out more about McKenzie Study Center and its ministries will be given at the end of today's program. Now, let's return to Jack and Christine.
Christine, for a number of months now, we've been trying to let our listeners know where we stand financially and asking them to contribute as they can. We've got lots of feedback that the program has been helpful to people in a number of different ways. But do you know how we stand financially right now?
The small contributions have kind of trickled in. And in terms of larger contributions, I think we've gotten two. We actually got two $8,000 contributions. And the second $8,000 contribution, the people ask that we match the funds. So they will give up to $8,000 dependent on how much is given up to that amount. So it's a possible $16,000 contribution, which is pretty significant, and it's very encouraging.
So any of the listeners out there who are willing to make a contribution to match the funds, they could support us to the tune of another $8,000 then?
Right.
Great.
Which is pretty exciting.
Yeah.
So thank you for contributing, and we again encourage you to consider contributing if this program has been beneficial to you.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of McKenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program, would like to order other programs, or want to know more about McKenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, please call us at 541-485-4801. Again, that's area code 541-485-4801. You can write us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And you may also find us on the net at www.mckenziestudycenter.org. Tapes can be purchased with check or Visa card. If you desire to support the ministry of McKenzie Study Center, your gift will be entirely tax deductible. Please mail your check to McKenzie Study Center. Again, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. The telephone number again, 541-485-4801. Now, On behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of McKenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.